1027 Business.
Welcome back to Hot Business on Hot 1027. So it's a Monday, so it is once again time for us to speak to the finance ghost. Ooh, it's the ghost. Hello. Welcome, Mr. Ghosty Man. I have. I was thinking we should get you a little sting every time you come on the show on Mondays to have a little ooh thing going. But yeah, so let's waste no time. Let's get straight into it. Last week was pretty busy on the SENS front. SENS, of course, Stock Exchange News Service. Companies report there first in order to give the entire market a fair opportunity to get access to new information at the first time. That's maybe getting a bit too technical, but that is its purpose. And on the SENS last week, a couple of interesting things came out. One, and we're going to jump straight in here, Massmart. Massmart came around knocking on our door in South Africa about 10 years ago. Well, not Massmart. Walmart came in knocking on Massmart's door, buying something like 49% of the business, if I'm not mistaken, and now have come for the rest, 51%, takeout offer at 62 Rand a share. Break it down for us, Mr. Ghost.
So they actually bought 51 originally, so they've actually controlled the business, and now they want to take out the rest. They're actually sitting at around 53 now. It's gone up a bit over the past decade, but basically, they entered the South African market sort of before our lost decade as a country. So, you know, it was the end of a bull market. It was FIFA World Cup fever. You know, South Africa was really on the map in many, many ways. And Walmart saw us as the entry point into Africa, which I think we still are as a country, ultimately. But, you know, what's happened in the past couple of years is Walmart had to keep Massmart alive, basically, through the pandemic, through the riots, and they needed to pump in quite a lot of money to do so. And ultimately, I think they're just a little bit tired of putting in all the effort, parachuting in a management team, you know, introducing their shared services infrastructure, and then they only have, like, whatever it is now, I think it's about 53% of the business. So I'm not surprised to see this offer come in to get the minorities out. And Walmart's lost a lot of money on this first sort of tranche of the investment. They paid, I think it was around 148 bucks a share back when they did the original deal. But the important point is that the rand at the time was trading at somewhere like 7 bucks to the dollar. You know, it's now at like over 17.30. So not only has the Massmart share price collapsed, but so has our currency. So the net impact on the dollar value of their investment has been severe. And they are now buying the dip of all dips, ultimately.
Okay. All right. Taking over the business, hopefully injecting new life into it. The Massmart group seems to have been in trouble for some time. So hopefully Walmart can come and make right. I just hope they don't rebrand it, you know, almost instantly. That would be kind of sad, but I suppose it's inevitable to happen at some point, right?
Yeah, in all likelihood. I mean, they won't do it straight away. I think there'll be a lot of sensitivities. You know, staff will have to get used to this idea of now being fully owned by Walmart. So I don't think that's going to happen straight away. But down the line, very possible. And ultimately, I think their focus is going to be on game. You know, that's the business that is particularly broken and needs to be sorted out. And that's not going to be easy because game strategy is all over the place, to be honest. The branding is very archaic. It's a bit of a dinosaur. It's like a department store for general merchandise, and that's a business model that just doesn't work in
and
the modern world.
Food at some point to the mix as well, which didn't really make sense.
The lowest margin of all categories is grocery, and it has the toughest supply chain. So you've really got to be a specialist operator to make grocery work. Game is not, and yet they had to go anyway. That was really the death knell, actually, for the previous management team. And that, I think, is part of what triggered Walmart to actually, you know, make the big move, bringing their own CEO, who ultimately is on his way out now, interestingly enough. So, you know how it is with American business. They don't waste time and they don't play games.
If you don't do the job, get out. So, a bit of an opinion-based question, I suppose. We see Amazon making moves to put up distribution centers here and hiring a huge amount of staff. And we see Walmart circling like vultures around what could probably be good assets, right? Is this a bit of a retail race for Africa coming from the Americans and using South Africa as their entry point? Or am I really just being ultra optimistic here?
I think it is that. You know, as an emerging market, we are still interesting. South Africans are very pessimistic. We're surrounded by it all the time, but we forget that on a global stage, when you put us next to other emerging markets, we are still interesting. Even if our GDP growth is not that amazing, we are still a solid place to come and do some business, and especially as a foothold into Africa. So ultimately the consumer is who wins here, you know, and retailers continue to have to compete. And as a consumer, I love the thought of being able to shop online potentially easily from an Amazon or a Takealot or perhaps an improved Massmart. You know, why wouldn't I? It's great. So it's going to be interesting to see what impact this has on, you know, the existing players in the market. They're going to need to compete at the highest level now.
Okay, and on the complete opposite end of the scale, we see international investors getting out of Absa. So this is it's been happening for a while. Barclays PLC bought a big stake in Absa, promptly turned around, decided they didn't want to do this anymore, and have since then been selling off in stages. And now the last piece of their stake, 7%, whatever it is, they did a book build and they placed the shares.
Yeah, it is interesting to just juxtapose it against, you know, Walmart coming in. But yeah, Barclays bought into Absa around 2005, I think it was. So that was height of the bull market. The South African economy was looking fantastic. In that came. And now this is their last tranche at 7.4% that they've sold through an accelerated book build, which basically means you appoint a banker to phone up all the institutional investors in the market and ask them how much Absa they want and at what price. And they managed to get it away at 169 a share, which is a bit of a discount to where it ended up last week at 180. Ultimately, it's just interesting because obviously these are big international corporate strategic decisions made a couple of years prior to being executed. I mean, they're really selling out of Absa at a time where the bank has actually been doing well and probably has pretty good prospects now. So it's just ironic. You know, I think equally Walmart is coming into Massmart at a time where it looks incredibly difficult to actually get it right. So this is just typical of how big international boards tend to make these decisions.
Yeah, I think this does smell a lot like a board decision that was made a number of years ago and a strategy was picked and we'll sell so much in these intervals and no matter what happens, this is our plan, we're sticking to it. Maybe not the best time to be a seller of banks in South Africa, but nonetheless, it is what happens. In other news, Fortress Real Estate Investment Trust may no longer be a real estate investment trust. What even happens in this situation?
So we haven't seen it before, but basically it reverts back to being a sort of standard company. It just happens to hold property. So absolutely the same as if you have a private company and you have a portfolio of property assets, that's what Fortress is going to become because the REIT status is reserved for listed companies that meet certain requirements. Fortress has fallen foul of those requirements, particularly regarding distributions for the different classes of shares. Basically what a REIT structure does is it just pushes the tax burden onto the investors. Why does that make sense? Because it's trying to attract pension funds who are tax exempt to invest in the sector, because if the actual company pays no tax and if the investor pays no tax, then there's literally zero tax leakage in the entire process from collecting the rent through to getting it into people's pension funds. So as Fortress loses this REIT status, what's going to be really interesting to see is the extent to which pension funds dump the stock if they haven't done so already, and who potentially climbs in and sees the opportunity here, because the other side of the coin with being a REIT is it is actually very limiting. And it puts a lot of difficult rules on your balance sheet, makes it quite tough, especially when market conditions are difficult. So I wonder if in years to come, Fortress will look back on this and think, you know what, that was actually the best thing to ever happen to us. I don't think it's impossible that we see that outcome.
Yeah. So, okay, so let me just recap. What are the requirements then to be a REIT? And is it something that you would want to get back later on? Sorry that I'm harping on this, but I'm trying to just wrap my head around that goes from being a sort of tax exempt, not really necessarily exempt, but a tax vehicle that you could use to invest into properties in a very tax efficient manner into just a regular company, which is subject to nominal income tax rates like any other company, right?
Yeah, so the first thing is you have to be listed. That's the first requirement. The second, there's a few, but the most important ones, you've got to be listed. You have to pay out a very high percentage of your income as distributions.
Something like
80%, you have to maintain, I think it's up at 75 to 80.
Okay, yeah.
And one of those, somewhere there. And the other one is your loan to value cannot be above 60%. So there's basically a cap on the amount of leverage you can use in the entity. So this becomes quite problematic when there's a real economic shock. Everyone always thought the property assets are bulletproof, and then along came a pandemic, you know, and demonstrated that perhaps not. So there were dispensations given over the pandemic for distributions, etc. But the overall point here is that a REIT is a big treadmill. Like, cash comes in and cash goes out to shareholders. So if they want to grow, they need to do it by raising money, which is how an advisor like Java Capital made a fortune for years, by just doing book build after book build after book build. There was a time on the JSE where there were two or three book builds a day in the property sector. And that was when the money was just flowing into the sector. And now we have a scenario where most of them are trading at a discount to net asset value, and they can't even raise equity capital. So again, you ignore market cycles at your peril.
Okay, well, there's an interesting time, I guess. We'll have to wait and see. And I think maybe let this be a bit of a warning shot. If the pension funds decide to get out because there's no longer a tax benefit in it for them, might put a lot of pressure on an already somewhat illiquid stock, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The timing of that will be interesting.
All right, great. And then I want to move on to sort of a more thematic investment thing. Master Drilling seems to be at the forefront of a brave new industry. You've likened it in your ghost bites that you do every week, that it's kind of like the gold rush, but selling shovels.
Yeah, so it's this concept of going further up the value chain, right? I mean, if you think that energy is a cycle you want to be in, then instead of trying to pick your winner in that, you know, you can just say, okay, well, where is a supplier to the entire sector? Because if I think that the mining and resources sector will do well, then all of them need, for example, mining services. You know, they will be doing a lot of exploration work and needing drilling because the cash is coming in and they need to start developing assets for the next cycle. So that's why Master Drilling has done so well. Their earnings per share, well, headline earnings per share was up more than 55% in the 6 months to June, which is great. And the share price is up over 40% in the past year. So, you know, the shovels in a gold rush strategy is not a bad one. And if you can't get the shovels, then you can at least get the drills in this case.
Yeah. And I mean, they are doing something a little differently with, I guess, new technology stuff. And this is part of the reason why I like a company like Jubilee Platinum, for example. No longer Platinum, I lie. Jubilee Metals Group. Because also they're using newer technology to get higher yields out of, already processed ore. Okay, not the same as Master Drilling, but they're using a new technology to basically drill holes in the ground and make it more efficient and cheaper for mines to mine. And if they are really truly the first, at the coalface as such, or as the saying goes, with this type of technology, then there is huge room for growth in them. And on the huge topic, huge group puts out a very cryptic acquisition notice. I'm not sure what to make of the Sens article that came out of Huge last week.
Yeah, it was a tricky one. So you might recognize the Huge Group name from their attempts to acquire Adapt.IT. They lost out to Valaris, the Canadian investor, got themselves into trouble with the TRP along the way. They released some videos that the regulator wasn't too happy with.
Sorry, TRP, just break that down.
That's Takeover Regulation Panel. So that's the regulator that deals with these sort of M&A transactions. They're being kept very busy at the moment. They're doing a whole bunch of investigations, including into Gold Leaf Tobacco, that business that's now been embroiled in all these allegations of smuggling cash. They were looking at Tongaat Hewlett, and the TRP ruled against that deal. And that's a whole other story for another day. But basically what Huge has done is they've announced the acquisition of a business called Interfile Group. The claim to fame is they built the e-filing system for SARS back in 2003. And here we are, many years later, and it still breaks during provisional tax, and I still couldn't do a PAYE return. But anyway, it is what it is. It's a good business that makes 80% of its revenue on an annuity basis. So now where the acquisition announcement gets quite cryptic, to your point, is it's not 100% clear how much Huge will actually own. They say they've agreed to a 44% stake. They're negotiating for a further 31. I would remind you that they were stuck with a very tiny stake in Adapt.IT they eventually had to get out of with much embarrassment. So I really hope they get it right this time. And then another investor called YW Capital will be coming in as the sort of BE partner, and there are a bunch of smart corporate financiers and investors up in Joburg. They'll hold around 25% in Interfile. So, what is interesting is they've paid a really good price. They valued the company at around $100 million, and the profit after tax was over $27 million in the last financial year. So they've paid a price earnings multiple of less than 4, which for an annuitized business is pretty good.
Okay, yeah, that does sound like a good investment at least. Let's hope that they can make the most of it. We don't want them to end up with egg on their face again like they did last time they got into a bidding war. But we shall see. So we've got about a minute left, Mr. Ghost. There's three things I want to cover. One, we saw some good results out of Truworths and Stadio. I mean, they're just essentially results, but they were relatively good. And then also what was interesting is that the, I guess, management team at Sibanye Gold, or Sibanye Stillwater now, is buying the dip. What do you make of that?
Yeah, so Neil Froneman and team have been climbing into the stock in a big way, so I'll start with that one. And interestingly enough, some of the other execs have bought even more than Froneman has bought. So, you know, for suffering Sibanye shareholders like me, it is nice to see them climbing in at these levels. And look, I bought Sibanye with a very long-term view around their battery metal strategy. So, you know, you've got to accept there'll be lots of volatility along the way. But it is always good to see a management team buying in. The other two you mentioned, I'll do true with first. So classic case of the perennial ugly duckling in a sector. If you draw a five-year chart of Truworths next to Fashini Group, Pepco, et cetera, it really doesn't look good. And it trades along those lines. You know, it trades at a fairly depressed multiple because people are tired. It doesn't really grow. So when it does release decent results, then people get quite excited. You know, sales were up. Margin was up. That was a big part of why this result was solid. Debt's quite low. The dividend was up nicely, although obviously there's a big base effect in there. So it's currently trading on a dividend yield. It bounces around, but somewhere between like 8.5% and 9%. So you can see it's not priced for growth. It's priced for yield. And that means if you think Truworths can continue growing, it's potentially quite cheap. If you think that it's going to just get stuck in a rut like it has been, then it's a classic case of a value trap. And a company that is very much a growth story but still hasn't been great for investors over the past year, or even since it was unbundled actually, is Stadio. The numbers look good. HEPS up 18%, student numbers up double digits. It's a good business. You know, it's growing its distance learning student base very quickly. No debt, great cash balance, but because all of this was already priced in, share price is down over 5% this year, last time I looked. Another good example of, you know, just be careful what you pay. You can buy the best company in the world, but if you overpay for it, you can get into trouble.
Yeah, I think last year there was a bit of a, well, over the last 2 years really, there was a bit of a hype around these companies really well positioned, distance learning is the future, they're going to make, you know, a killing doing this. And, you know, rightly so over the next 10 years, but I think maybe the market got a bit overexcited during the pandemic about it and pushed the price a bit too far, as it tends to. And now it'll probably go too far in the other direction, which will then present a great opportunity to buy it, right? So
potentially, yep. And people are too bearish on Kira. You know, that was the sort of ugly duckling that was left behind when Stadio was unbundled with a great, big, exciting story. I actually hold Kira, so we'll see how that pans out, because I generally like to buy the sort of cheaper-looking stock, bigger margin for error. When something is priced for perfection, if it doesn't hit perfection, it hurts you. And that we see on the market all too often.
Well, on that note, we have to call it a day. Mr. Ghost, thank you very much for joining us. It's always great talking to you and having you explain to us some of the latest, well, some of last week's biggest movers in terms of news. It's nice to get a decent view and a nice roundup of what's moving markets, or at least what moved markets last week. Obviously, this week, a whole new kettle of fish, lots of things already out, which you and I will talk about next week. But thank you very much for your time. All right, that was The Finance Ghost. You can find him at thefinanceghost.com. Hot 1027 Business.